Dr. Brian Halverson is one of the UK's leading holistic dentists. He is the author of Great Teeth for Life and lectures widely to the public and to health practitioners. Brian is passionate about providing preventative information to guide us through all the stages of our lifetime. To find out more about Brian, go to www.brianhalverson.com. And now here is Dr. Brian Halverson.
I can see clearly now, the rain is gone. I can see all obstacles in my way.
It is my great pleasure to introduce Patricia Warby. I met Patricia at the main event, that the Chrysalis Effect, which is about recovery for chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia, and have outstanding results. Now, the Chrysalis Effect was founded by Elaine Wilkins, and one of the main practitioners who has been on her course is actually Patricia. Patricia, how did you end up, meeting Elaine and being such a vital part of helping people through the Chrysalis Effect?
Hi, Brian. I was a therapist at the time. I was a massage therapist. I've been doing massage therapy probably for about 10 years now. But I was having some problems with people coming to me with chronic pain. In particular, fibromyalgia, which is a really intractable condition and doesn't seem to respond so well to purely physical therapy. And I was beginning to wonder if I was missing a trick somewhere. And I happened to notice Elaine was doing a talk at one of the conferences that I go to every year, which is a complementary and alternative medicine expo, CAM Expo, it's called. And it just seemed to ask the questions that I was asking, you know, what is fibromyalgia, what are chronic conditions and why do they occur? And I went along and heard her speak, and it just absolutely sort of blew me away, because it was so, it answered so much that I had been wondering myself, and gave me a real insight into these conditions and the complexity of them. And so I contacted Elaine afterwards and learned that they were in fact about to launch a practitioner training scheme. And I signed up, and that's how it began, really. And I did a really full training course with them, which I then continued on. Once I'd done the practitioner training, I also did a well-being coaching training as well. So I really built my skills up and began to understand why it was I wasn't having so much effect just from purely physical therapy.
Yes, that's very interesting, because I was very much the same. That a lot of our listeners might be saying, well, why are we talking about chronic fatigue when this should be about, my show should be about dentistry? But part of being called the integrated dentist is actually looking at the way that we are not just a mouth on legs. You know, we are whole body. And at the conference where we met, I was totally impressed by where I could see that there were deep-seated psychological problems, many of them that could be caused by possibly traumatic experience, emotional traumatic experiences, at the dentist. So this is where I think that we all have to come together. And if you could just explain, even from your own background, how you've got to where you are, and how you can see the scars of dentistry being involved, even from your own experience.
Sure, yes, okay. Well, the first thing to say is that some people can have dentistry and it be no problem at all. I think the factor to bear in mind is what's happened before to the child that's going for dentistry and what sort of personality style have they got? Because for me, I was a sensitive child. I use that term very carefully because although sometimes it's seen as a negative, it does actually have some positive connotations as well. But I was quite shy. I was quite well aware of things. I could always pick up atmospheres and know what was going on with other people. I was very empathetic and so on. But unfortunately, I was also addicted to sugar and I therefore suffered quite a lot of dental issues when I was when my second teeth were coming through. So from about the age of 7, 8 through to my late teens, I had an awful lot of extractions of my teeth because they were all very, very crowded. My dental arch didn't form properly, and in those days the technology wasn't what it is now. You didn't expand the arch, you simply took the teeth out to fit the narrow space. So I unfortunately had a needle phobia as well. That didn't help. So it meant that most of my extractions were done under gas anesthesia. And we are talking the sort of late 60s, early 70s, when the technology wasn't as, you know, wasn't as pleasant as it is now. You were often strapped in the chair or held down. You would have a big, I can only describe it sort of like a gas mask put over your face, which smelled horrible because it still, I presume, had residues of the gas in it, or it just was made of material that did smell. I was never quite sure. And then you'd be told to breathe in and you would lose consciousness fairly quickly. But I was always absolutely terrified of this process, terrified of actually losing consciousness and the whole process of going in and being held and my mother there anxiously, you know, waiting for me. And I just found it absolutely terrifying, and it just kept on happening. I just went time after time after time after time. And so what I now realize is, of course, that it's a surgery. It is a surgery, and we have to acknowledge it as such. It isn't benign to a sensitive child. It actually does create a great deal of anxiety. And that, interestingly enough, changes the way the brain interprets threat. So when you're young, your brain is still forming. It isn't fully formed until you're about 23, 24. It's later in men. And so my brain was sort of getting these messages of terrific threat and stress on a regular basis. And that's recognized now as a form of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, called complex PTSD. Because when the brain is sort of adapting to those regular occurrences, it kind of makes the stress system very much more hypersensitive. And that's what happened to me, basically. So, yeah.
That's very interesting, because I did bring it up on another show, but when I was 6 years old, had a very similar experience to yourself, where I, as a six-year-old, was completely unaware that I would be turning up at a surgery to have four of my large molar teeth, which at 6 years old, had, it's a bit like yourself, had already decayed. And the treatment was to say, well, let's, you know, expression goes sometimes with wisdom teeth, if in doubt, whip them out. And and I really was apprehensive because I knew something was going to happen to me, which I felt wasn't really going to be in my best interest psychologically. But I had an anaesthetist who came out and spoke to me and said, do you know much about men going up in space? And we are a bit like yourself. We're looking at, in fact, for me, it was about 1956. So possibly even more primitive. But in fact, I said, yes, I was a bit of a bright child. And I said, yes, I do know about men going up in space. And he said, when they go up in space, do you realize that there isn't any air up there? So I said, yes, I know that, because I was a bit of a bright kid at that age. And so he said, well, we've got a gas here that they breathe in to keep them alive when they're up in space. he said, would you like to try it? So, of course, I nodded. I literally picked the mask up and stuck it on my own face. Now, you're absolutely right that you had this horrendous smell, which was a bit like, I think, almost like the rubber of it. I'm not quite sure. Mm. But the fact is that because of the introduction, you know, I was literally out cold without any trauma.
Yeah.
And now, to me, this is a classic case of the singer, not the song. You know, that if you can create the right environment, you can reduce this traumatic sort of emotional scar, which obviously is the title of your book, you know, the scar that won't heal. And I can fully understand that if I would have been treated differently, my whole experience of dentistry would have really focused on that critical time. And on an everyday basis, I still think that virtually there's not one day that I goes by where I haven't got patients who have serious, almost phobias about coming, even if it's just for a checkup. So I fully concur with what you're saying. And could you explain just how it gets locked into people's psyche, for, you know, and really is so difficult to remove?
Okay, so the first thing to point out, the difference between your experience and my experience was you chose to pick up the mask, okay, because you'd been given a good potential outcome. You had volition in that case. You felt it was going to be exciting and interesting and you wanted to give it a go. In my experience, I was helpless and not choosing to go through the experience. I was being forced to go through the experience. And so the sort of chemical environment, the neurotransmitters going around in my brain were probably rather different to yours. I would have been exhibiting a heightened stress response, which is mediated by parts of the brain called the HPA axis. And H stands for hypothalamus, P is the pituitary, and A actually leads to the adrenal glands, which are outside the brain, obviously. But the three are linked in a massive interconnecting cascade of hormones and neurotransmitters. So when the brain initially perceives a threat, it activates a part of the brain called the limbic system. And this is a survival part of our brain, really. It's designed to help us overcome threats with either fight, flight, or freeze. And obviously, in my case, I couldn't fight the dentist, although I probably did push him a bit. I certainly couldn't run away because I was being held down. And freeze was probably all that I was available for me, and I would just succumb. How it gets locked in is because once that stress response gets stimulated enough times, the elevated stress hormones like adrenaline, noradrenaline, and cortisol sort of become much more readily, I suppose, excreted out of the body. They basically become super sensitive. And what then happens is the nature of memory, which, you know, most of us understand that we have memories, but that they decay with time and they can change according to our emotional feelings and so on. But there are actually two types of memory in the brain. And there is what's called implicit or traumatic memory, and that gets stored in a very different place from the normal area. It gets stored in this part of the limbic system that's stimulated by stress. And these memories don't decay, and they don't have any sense of time either. So they're always in the now. And so when a really bad thing happens to a child, it's particularly in childhood, although it does occur in adulthood as well. But as I've explained, for reasons of the brain being immature, the child is more likely to get this hypersensitive stress response. So these implicit memories get laid down as a sort of permanent record of threat. And then what happens in a later experience, if you experience the same feeling, the same emotion, it sort of becomes rekindled. It comes up from this permanent memory store and is flooding the body with these chemicals. And so you are reliving past traumas at the same time as you're experiencing the current one. So it's sort of cumulative and persistent, and it doesn't decay. So it's a really huge, massive onslaught of the body via these stress hormones, and it has really long-lasting effects in the psyche, which make you avoid certain things that are likely to trigger you. So that's where the phobias come in. And it can change the whole way you live your life.
This is such a fascinating point you're bringing up here, because are we looking that this one incident as a child, or several, literally forms as part of what I will call the negative memory bank? You know, it's a crude way of putting it, and obviously, with yourself looking at this at a PhD level, I'm really talking about it as a layperson. That, so are you, if I'm correct in what you're saying, is building up a bank of negativity in terms of storage, which if other of life stresses occur, literally just exacerbate the previous ones, or vice versa?
Yeah, so that's absolutely right. So what you've got is you've got laid down these implicit memories. Now, bear in mind, for an implicit memory or traumatic memory to form, there has to be an element of helplessness present at the time of the event. So it's not every memory that becomes traumatic. And indeed, with some children who are of a more robust personality, or they simply don't interpret the meaning of the event as so dangerous as I did. I was a sensitive child, and that's about 20% of the population who have this sort of sensitivity from birth. So it's a combination of things, but yes, it certainly does accumulate a negative trail, if you like, of traumatic memories, which are instantly accessible to the brain given a new situation that mimics the past one. And the body and the brain work together to sort of flood your body with the stress hormones in order for you to actually survive. It's a survival mechanism so that you can run or fight or collapse. As I've said, fight, flight and freeze are the three responses available to you. And unfortunately, for a number of people in adulthood, freeze becomes a sort of classic response to any trauma, and they get chronic disease as a result.
Yes, and this is where I think there is this link between the introduction, where we're talking about chronic fatigue, where, as far as I gather, my, view for a long time on health disease is that I tend to look at it like a bucket effect, that we all can accumulate stresses, be it environmental, be it nutritional, be it physical, and obviously, and I think very importantly, psychological, and we can actually appear to be relatively healthy until the bucket gets filled up, and then the accumulation of everything tends to overflow, and that overflow is where the body cannot cope anymore, and it tends to just go into a disease process. And I think, and this is a personal view, that it could be in terms of a pain or a chronic fatigue, but it also could be heart disease, cancer, and everything else. Would you agree with the sort of basic principle of what I would call the bucket effect, where we can cope with so much? And of course, depending on the individual, is how much we get to the point where the bucket overflows.
Yeah, absolutely right. We use a teacup, which is funny. In the chrysalis effect, we use a teacup and we say that the teacup overflows. But I like the bucket probably because it's a bit bigger and suggests that perhaps you can handle a bit more. But it is. It's with all chronic disease, it is a combination of different events that happen. It's not just the psychological, it's nutritional, it's toxicity. You know, it's everything that accumulates in the body and is registered by the body and mind as stressful. Stress is not just the obvious things. It's not just, you know, if you have financial difficulties or relationship problems or anything like that. It can be unconscious. And the important thing to note about the stress response that I just mentioned in the HPA axis is it's largely an unconscious stress response to learned events in your past. And so actually this is why we're often flooded with feelings that we don't understand without actually recalling what it was that initially made us feel the way we do. And so it becomes completely bewildering for people. And they've no idea why they get these symptoms, some of which are, as you correctly said, pain. Chronic pain is a classic mind-body symptom of unresolved emotional memory. It's also the nutritional, and, you know, it has other complex parts to it that need, addressing. But the psychological emotional is often the bit that's missed. I think because people misunderstand that when you say there is a mind-body element, you're not saying it's all made up and it's the person themselves causing the problem. This is an innate response that you have no control over. It's the way the brain is designed to help us survive in Paleolithic times, which, of course, had very short, sharp shocks in life. You didn't have chronic stress in your life. You either got eaten by the tiger or you survived. And you lived in communities that supported you, so you often had mitigation of stress response. These days, people live such isolated lives. They're eating fairly toxic, nutritionally depleted foods. And they're living in an environment where they're being bombarded by EMFs, electromagnetic frequencies, and toxicity generally in the home and outside. So it really is the perfect storm of conditions that lead us to these chronic pain and fatigue conditions. But it certainly has all the elements that you've said with other chronic disease as well. And I certainly believe there's an element of stress in cancer, which after all is a failure of the immune system. And the immunity is absolutely linked to stress because, as you know, when you're under stress, your immunity goes down. You'll have noticed you tend to get colds and flu when you're stressed, and so it's a very common and well understood link. So it really is a fascinating part of mind body medicine that's often missed.
I think what resonated when I listened to your excellent talk at the Chrysalis Effect event was the fact that I was reading and researching, I think it was one of the major complementary famous cancer clinics. I think it's in New Mexico, where the first, doesn't matter how seriously you are affected in terms of which stage of cancer you've got, that when you go to this clinic, the first part of it is speaking to people like yourself who actually has to find out what is the psychological element. And unless they can clear that, and they're saying they normally have to go right the way back to childhood before they can really say that whatever other therapies they do have got a greater chance of being successful. But they take the psychological element as a major issue in terms of hoping to get the recovery of this particular, person who may be in all sorts of, in this case they're dealing with cancer. And I think this is what resonated with when I spoke to yourself, is that we have to work together to understand it. And obviously what I'm totally impressed is how you embrace all the other elements that can create this disease. I mean, I call it dis-ease process in the body and mind.
This is a holistic approach. It's a naturopathic approach as well, and it says that you can't heal a multifactorial condition with, a one magic pill solution, whether that be a supplement or a drug. You have to look at how the body and the mind work together to create health or disease. And I love the fact that you've said dis-ease, because it really is the clue's in the name there, isn't it? So we really have to look at, when we're helping people with these conditions, we have to approach it multifactorially and look at all the elements, whether they be psychological, emotional, or physical, nutritional, because we can't use the current sort of medical fix-it model to sort people's lives in the way that they need them. They need to see where they're living inauthentically, where the stresses are. And some of that is childhood stuff. Some of that is how they're currently living. But you do have to approach it if you want to heal. It's the missing link, really.
Yes, and we've all gone through our life stresses, and I think some of my what I'll call lifestyle gurus who have helped me were people like Dr. Wayne Dyer, Deepak Chopra. I mean, ones that have been sort of around for years, but also universally put over a very good message. My only concern, however, was that if I may use the expression, scar runs that deep, and or like in my situation where I'm obviously helping people with examples of areas of detoxing and nutrition, if you say, for example, have a brain that is not accepting these new messages and ways of changing, then I always worried that if the brain was so polluted, how do you literally get onto these what I'll call higher levels of lifestyle behavior and coping mechanisms? Where I think what I loved about what you're trying to do is you're trying to drill down to clear that area so that you can then start building from a much, what should we say, healthier base. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think it is. And what you must understand about that is that your belief systems and your subconscious thought processes are so much stronger than you ever believed possible. And they can often override the negative signals that you're getting from, say, toxicity in your body. So people pay a lot of attention to detoxing their body, but they often ignore detoxing their mind. There was a great book actually written by a guy called Dr. Bruce Lipton, The Biology of Belief, and it came out, I think, about 9-10 years ago. And it really showed you how belief systems and these subconscious programs that you're running either can create health or disease. And in the majority of people who've not really approached their emotional healing, they're helping to keep the body in a state of illness, inflammation, which we know is at the heart of a lot of chronic disease. So actually, it is possible to reverse these early programs that you've been inadvertently running. You have to do it in ways that are not just about thinking, though, and this is quite important. So when you read books like that, the ones that you mentioned by Deepak Chopra and so on, they are very inspiring, and you come away thinking, great, I really want to make changes. But there is an element by which your subconscious mind is not necessarily agreeing with that process, because to your subconscious, the strategies you have in place are actually about keeping you safe. And safety is really, really key in recovery. You have to find a way to change the brain and to change the way it responds to stress. And I do that using body-oriented therapies. And that's where my previous training in massage came in really handy, because I became aware that actually people need touch. They need comfort. They need security in order to make these changes. And simply thinking, oh, well, I'm going to live a better life and stop thinking that way is simply not enough. And we have to approach this sense of threat and replace it with a sense of safety if we're going to make significant changes to the way the brain is operating. So it really is plastic, but you need the right tools. When you have the right tools, actually the process is remarkably quick.
Really? Yes. I mean, what I was very impressed at reading your book as well is you were saying that often people feel there's something wrong with them because they've reacted a different way, say to be a telling off or to a social conditioning, and they almost are blaming themselves. Where I think you were saying that really it's that everyone's such an individual, and they have their brain interprets things, as you rightly say, in a threat or what have you. And it could be where somebody else says, well, there's nothing wrong with this, but for that individual, it is a key trigger which actually causes that sort of, trauma, which isn't cleared. I mean, we always think of things like the child abuse and the real serious things, but I think you were saying that it's not only just those really serious things that can actually set off this sort of negative spiral.
That's right. So what's key for everyone to understand really is it's not the nature of the event itself, it's the meaning to that individual. Meaning is key here, because we are complex social creatures. And in order to survive in a social environment, we have to know what's safe and what isn't. Now, you're quite right. So two people may have the same event happen to them. Maybe it's a bereavement or a loss, which is always difficult for everyone to go through. But for one person, it'll be a relatively straightforward recovery. And for the other person, it'll crush their lives. And the difference here is the meaning that they've attributed to that loss. And if the meaning is, I am terrible and everybody I love dies, or I am shameful and no one's ever going to love me now, then that is crucial for long-term, you know, health and well-being. You're never going to be well if those are the kind of belief systems you're carrying in your body. So meaning is really key here. And that's the bit that you have to sort of uncover as you work with someone to uncover these beliefs that you have. And just one more thing I want to say on that is that two of the greatest emotions that I've found that drive these illnesses are shame and betrayal. Shame, because we know shame is an important modifier of the child's behavior in your early years. Shame is used to encourage good behavior, but to obviously disincentivize negative behavior. But it can also be a chronic problem where you are shamed constantly, particularly if, you know, you have parents who are not very good at raising you without shame, and also you have bullying in your, you know, school life or from siblings. Shame is a really big driver, and it means basically I am bad, wrong, whatever. You're interpreting the problem as with yourself, which is what children do. They're magical thinkers, so everything revolves around them. And the other one is betrayal, which, you know, even a death can be seen as a betrayal if you are left with a parent who is then less than competent or anxious or difficult. So there are many events in life, some of which are major, like as you said, we call those big T traumas. And there are other events which are not necessarily, but if they're continual and repeated, these small T traumas can be just as damaging if, to that person, they are significant.
Yes, I when you said shame, immediately it sort of sent a sort of almost the hackles on my neck raising, because when I look at the or read the for the first time Power versus Force, and you looked at the levels of consciousness, and you looked at the lowest level of consciousness being death, and the next level, which has very low energy, and low energy is equivalent to negativity of any whatever you want to compare it with, shame was the next one above death. So I totally resonate when you talk about using shame as a mean to condition or motivate, especially our children.
It's one we have to be really careful of, particularly with a sensitive child. A sensitive child is already running the program that I'm wrong, bad, different. So we don't need to use it quite as much as we would with a more confident child. And we just have to understand that we're all very different psychologically, and therefore our responses are going to be complex and variable. And so, you know, a parent needs to understand this, that if they have a sensitive child, they have to moderate their approach in behavior control. The child is picking up the signals already before you even say anything. So Shame is a terrible burden to carry through into your adult life, and it affects everything you do. It affects the relationships you have. As we've said, it affects your general health. You know, it may affect the way you see your career path, you know, and stop you doing all the things you'd like to do. So it's a major driver of behavior.
No, I think we're looking at really getting down to what I'll call core issues. May I ask, when dealing with your clients, how, for the person who would say like to see you, what would be the normal process? Meaning, I know that you're flexible, but I believe that you, if I may say, have got quite a unique insight onto this. And whereas I think that in the USA, you know, virtually anyone who's got the slightest problem tends to go to a therapist, I think in the UK especially, it's regarded very much more as people regard it as almost failure if they have to go and speak or have consultations with people like your good self. I can see the total opposite, that, you know, we all carry scars. Mm. And when we're looking at things like when I've attended, again, the chronic fatigue with the chrysalis effect, that what I've noticed is that we're all almost, in today's busy, polluted environment, we're always just literally a hair's breadth away from going into that collapsed state.
Yeah.
And all I'm saying is that having discovered you, how do you run your clinics, or, you know, if, say, somebody wanted to approach you?
Okay, I'm going to answer that question, but first I'm just going to say that I agree with your point about those of us in the UK and these more reserved cultures. We don't like to think of ourselves as having needing help, and certainly that was my situation when I fell ill, because I had chronic fatigue in my 30s, and I did consider it a failure when I had to go into counselling and therapy. Obviously, I've changed my view now, as I see it as a much more proactive state. It should really be something that you do as sort of clearing yourself and making the most of your body and your mind to live a healthy and wholehearted life. That's not to say you should be in therapy all the time, but it's definitely a way of approaching life that means prevention is worth, you know, much more than cure. It's so much easier to get in there and deal with stuff before it becomes a problem. And how I actually approach it now as a therapist, you're right, I do have a very eclectic approach, which I've sort of come to through experience, through my own and through dealing with other people's issues. Firstly, it starts with creating an environment of safety. That is absolutely paramount. Nobody who comes to see me can feel unsafe. And if they do, I'm not the right person for them. So we start with grounding. We ground through the body. We may do that through a process called havening, which uses touch. We may use it a process of tapping, which is called emotional freedom technique or EFT. And that's a great way of grounding through the body and actually allowing the emotions to come up, but without feeling overwhelmed. So you know that you can deal with them, and they actually dissipate once they're examined and allowed to flow through the body. Because emotions are simply energy. They are energy in motion. That's in fact where the word emotion comes from. Emotion is from the Latin emovare, to move. So it wants to move through you, but it can't do because it's blocked by these feelings of threat. And so, establishing safety after, of course, I've taken a full history and I know what's going on for the person. We explore very, very gently some of the issues that they're facing, and we use a variety of different body-oriented techniques, sometimes hypnotherapy, sometimes EFT, sometimes I use eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, which is EMDR. So I have a toolbox, if you like, that I bring out dependent on what that person brings to me on the day, really. And it's very variable. And it's often that the brain knows what it needs to clear. So it's whatever comes up. people will often say to me, oh, I don't know why this has just occurred to me, and it's really random, but, and then they'll describe something that's either happened to them recently or some memory that they have in the past, and I say it's not random. It's not at all. The brain is a healing, you know, mechanism. It's bringing these things up deliberately for you so that you can clear them, and that's what we do. We do it gently. It's like peeling the layers of an onion gradually till we get to the middle, you know, the inside. And it's wonderfully revealing for people to realize that they can do this for themselves. The great thing about EFT and havening is it can be done by the person at home as well, so that the therapy doesn't just happen in the clinic. It happens while they're, you know, facing real life situations at home too. And I give them tools that they can take away so that they're not stuck anymore having to rely on, you know, antidepressants or sleeping tablets or whatever it is that they've had up to now to sort of keep the symptoms at bay. Symptoms are just an unresolved issue in the body and need clearing. So once you clear the real cause, the symptoms gradually go away.
Well, I think we could most likely continue this get further and further into issues which I think you are bringing up in your, perspective. And I just love the integrated approach you make and using different therapies to suit the individual, which obviously is very much common sense. Patricia, if anyone wants to find you, where would they go to find you?
Okay, so I have a website. In fact, I have two. I have my therapy website is www.alchemy, A-L-C-H-E-M-Y, therapies, all one word, alchemytherapies.co.uk. And that sort of tells you a lot about my approach. And then I also have a general one, which is everything about me, a bit more history, and that's patriciawarby.co.uk. So my surname is spelled W-O-R-B-Y. So they can find me that way. Love to hear from them.
Okay, lovely. And just to reiterate, your latest book, The Scar.
Yep,
that
I'm writing.
Heal, yes, by yourself. All right,
so,
and you are saying, you're writing another one as well.
Yeah, at the moment I'm writing one on the microbiome, because that's something I haven't raised with you. But the bacteria that live in your gut are not just good and bad bacteria, as we've kind of been taught. They are a whole community living within you, and they produce a lot of the neurotransmitters and a lot of the hormones and vitamins that your body needs to function. And so it's a fascinating area, which I think is complementing the mind-body approach that I use. And so if you understand that we are a host for these organisms, and so, you know, the thoughts we think, the foods we eat, the lifestyle we live is very much going to impact them and vice versa. So that's my current book that I'm writing at the moment. That's going to be called The World Within, so look out for that one.
I should be fascinated with that. As you know, this has been my current subject, looking at the oral microbiome and how that affects the rest of the body. I suppose, just as a headliner, I'm sure you mention it in the book very much, is the fact that we are approximately made up of 10 trillion cells, and yet living in us and on us are 100 trillion microbes. And you almost beg the question, who lives on who? If we're looking at, and especially if you, which you appertained about emotions, when we're looking at an energetic level. So really, I think we're now into an era of science where we're looking at combining not just biochemistry, but also biophysics and quantum physics. And this becomes so clear, but it also explains why often therapies work, things don't work, and often why, as you rightly say, things like drugs often will only have a temporary effect, because we're looking at it at a far too superficial level.
Definitely. It's all about energy. At the end of the day, it's all about energy. Thoughts are energy, you know, beliefs are energy. And when you see someone transform in front of you, you feel the energy suddenly moving, and it's quite palpable. I can certainly pick it up in you know, sitting opposite someone, even online. I work a lot online as well, and you can see it and hear it in their voice when they've made a shift. And so energy is absolutely at the key of this. We've so focused on molecules and you know, we've omitted this whole complex information store that is the energy in our bodies.
Well, absolutely fascinating. And I really, really, on behalf of our listeners, thank you for spending the time to really illuminate us in such an important area. So thank you again, Patricia.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Brian.
Now, finally, I'd like to talk about stress and how it affects our teeth and jaws. The first thing to say is that we all are under stress in one way or the other. And I believe these days, with modern society, stress is no respecter of age. So if you think of our children having to take exams, generally having to adapt to changes in their hormones, everything else, right the way through to the elderly with our worries, we all are under stress. Now, often when I'm seeing patients, I'll ask them how they're going, and they think I'm just being polite, which to a certain degree, I am genuinely interested in how their life has been, especially since the last time I've seen them 6 months ago. But also, if it's some negative responses, or well, you know, job's a bit uncertain, or we've had some family crises, I then ask about things like, how are you in terms of your teeth? Are you having any discomfort? But also, I'll also mention about things like, you know, are you getting any clicking in your jaws? Are you suffering from any headaches, backaches? And often the answer is in the sort of negative positive. Yes, I am. And this is because often stress that we're always trying to cope with can be translated into neuromuscular and osteopathic problems. The lower jaw, or the mandible, is actually continuous from one side of our head to the other. And it is linked to the skull by what we call the TMJ joint, or temporomandibular joint. Now, this you can feel if you put your fingers in front of your ear and then slowly open your mouth, and you'll be able to see that the movement of the joint as you press your fingers onto it. Now, often a lot of people find that this can cause clicking if it's slightly out of balance, and in more severe situations can actually lead to difficulty in opening. Now, it can be that our teeth are not quite in alignment, and that can actually cause the clicking. But for most people, these joints become problematic when in fact we're under stress, and the neuromuscular feedback tends to tighten the joints, and often some muscles put pressure on the joint in the wrong direction, and hence it, sometimes in some severe cases, the joint can actually be completely dislocated. Now, the joint itself may have been traumatized in the past, and this can be anything from a blow to the side of the face. It could be from a whiplash injury, and sometimes even just purely opening too wide and dislocating it, and then really the joint has never recovered. So there's a number of factors that can make the joint susceptible to a neuromuscular tension brought on by stress. Now, what is fascinating about the TMJ is that there is what we would call in dentistry a TMJ syndrome, which means that various other clinical symptoms that may not be quite related to the joint actually can be traced back to it. One of the things can be headaches, backache, neck ache, even lower back pain can all be traced back to an imbalance of the jaw. Now, most osteopaths would fully recognize this, but often if the joint, your hip joint, is not in alignment with your TMJ or jaw joint, then in fact the services of an osteopath can often help remedy this. But often most of us are always sort of stuck between having a clinically insignificant situation, which something like stress can just bring it on so that it becomes noticeable. Now, I said earlier that this isn't just confined to the adult population. And one of the things I often see is when our children who may be taking their GCSE or A-level exams, they often come in saying that their jaws feel very tight, that they're clenching their teeth, they're getting headaches, and it's all because they're under stress. Now, this is not always negative stress. It can be just the fact that they're focusing their mind on a situation such as studying for their exams, and they're forgetting about things like posture, relaxation. Of course, this is much more manifest when we come to the sort of sedentary jobs we do, such as in front of a computer or what have you. And so often the stress isn't just about severe problems, lifestyle and life event problems. It can just be that it builds up due to, say, physical positioning or not relaxing. A very good example is the fact that people who often drive a lot, they don't realize that they're actually clenching their teeth. Now, this over months and years can often lead to not only trauma on the TMJ joint, but on all the teeth, because the teeth are being pressurized unnecessarily and can lead rise to things like tooth sensitivity. And because there's so much pressure, the gums can be actually inflamed. Getting back to our children and exams, another thing that often children come in with and say, look, you know, my teeth are all sensitive, and have I got some holes that developed? And you look at them and their teeth are absolutely in lovely condition. And then you say, well, have you got any exams on at the moment? Sure enough, yes. And again, it's the fact that this clenching, often unconsciously, will tend to give rise to the sensitivity in the teeth. Now, a lot of this clenching and tension is not always during the daytime. And in the nighttime, often we all tend to sleep in a certain pattern, i.e. on our side or what have you. And under stress and tension, we tend to find that we clench up. Now, the reason I say that is because most people would say, well, okay, you've described the whys. Now, can you say, how can we help this? Well, the first thing is to be aware that you are actually clenching your teeth. And during conscious hours, often I have a little mnemonic, which is a little bit peculiar, and it is lips gently together and teeth apart. Now, if you just try that, you have what I would call a gormless expression, mainly because you're actually trying to relax all your face and keep your teeth sort of just apart enough. And although it seems like that, it does marvels for helping to relax the joint. And often when you realize and catching yourself clenching, you can just actually think, right, stop, relax. It's a bit like a lot of these defined therapies where we're looking at posture and the right type of movement. And this is really the same for the jaw. If you find something like this is not fully working and you're still getting headaches, feel like you're tensing up too much, then often have a word with your dentist and he could possibly prescribe various exercises you can do. But also, if it really becomes to the point of saying, well, you know, I just know that I'm under so much stress and load, what can you actually do for me? Then often one of the most simplistic and non-invasive ways is to actually make a little plastic guard that you just pop in and mainly wear at night. The interesting thing is that what it's actually doing is keeping your teeth just a little bit apart. And that tends to give the neuromuscular feedback, which means that the jaws of your TMJ at the back of the mouth can just actually relax. And often if these little, what we call night splints, are worn, as said, at night, often it can just break the cycle of this clenching and tension. If people have these, what I'll call splints, or require one, and they are under severe stress, I often say, you know, wear them, say, for example, on driving or sat in front of a computer, so that in effect, it just again helps to relax. The beauty of it is that when there are less stressful conditions, you can find that you don't just put it in the drawer by the side of the bed, or in fact, but you've always got it there. And as I say, it's non-invasive and doesn't do any harm to your jaw or teeth. Now, as a little sort of, I suppose, story, I once had a lady who was fairly, what should we say, renowned in the media, and she was undergoing a lot of stress. And in fact, we made her a splint to wear. But because of the degree of stress, we found that she was so dependent on it that in fact we often made three or four at a time because she actually wore them out. That's how severe the clenching and tension can be. But it worked. Where this TMJ syndrome becomes part of holistic treatment is the fact that virtually your dentist will understand and will be able to help you. But to take it another level, and here we're talking about the integrated dentist, I would always recommend that look at and find, say, a good osteopath, cranial osteopath, chiropractor, who can actually work with the dentist to give you the best treatment to sort out something which often can be really very affecting your lifestyle, in the sense that you're under stress and you're getting headaches, painful jaws, difficulty in opening, which is just compounding and making that downward spiral in terms of your health and well-being. I hope this will give a little bit of clue over what is a quite an involved subject, and I've just given a very brief overview. I will be coming back to the subject of stress and how it affects our mouth and teeth and jaws, because there are sorts of chemical reactions as well. But enough for today, and I wish you abundance, health and happiness, and thank you for listening.
I can see clearly.